untrained eye, the books of Chronicles are simply a cut and paste of the books of Samuel and Kings, but this does the books a disservice. Look hard enough and you will find plenty of new material, not just the old stories spun and rehashed as propaganda to motivate the former exiles who were struggling to make a go of things back in Israel. However, there is little new news that pivots the central story of the Bible in a wholly new direction. Much of the original content simply adds to or embellishes stories and characters with which the Bible is already familiar. Those of you who've kept with the podcast from the beginning will recognise this. If you're new, don't worry, I'll point out where the accounts differ. In a nutshell, the purpose of the books of Samuel and Kings was to remind Jews in exile how they got to be there, while the books of Chronicles' job is to inspire the returnees to ruined Israel that God has not abandoned them. It's worth keeping this in mind when people tell you that every letter of the Bible is true and that these are both factual accounts. All these three books are political and serve a greater function than to simply recount facts. The truth is no doubt in there somewhere. Many of the kings talked about in the books are verifiable historical characters, and it would be foolish to dismiss the accounts here as fiction any more than the other accounts we have of these rulers outside of the Bible, or extra-biblical to use the correct term. As ever, Holy Bible focuses on the story and leaves you, the listener, to make up your own mind as to whether any of it is true or not. My name is Chaz Bayfield, and this is Holy Bible, Episode 96, Jezebel's Daughter. Welcome back, and thanks for listening to this, one of the few, if not the only, podcasts about the Bible that doesn't A, try and force you to believe, or B, do everything it can to prove the Bible is baloney. It must also be one of the few podcasts approaching its 100th episode that, at the time of recording, hasn't received a single star rating, good or bad, on any channel. Stars, listener, are the holy grail for podcasters. They ramp us up the charts and allow others to hear about us. So, if you've not thought of telling Apple, Spotify or Amazon how much you're enjoying this slow drive through the Bible, maybe today is the day. As for today's podcast, we're pulling up in the middle of the second book of Chronicles, one of the least visited of the Bible's books, a kind of biblical Wyoming. But I love it, and I hope you will too. Here goes. In the first book of Kings, King Abijah of Judah's son Asa is a godly ruler who fights Israel but also pays protection money to the king of Aram. Here in the second book of Chronicles, the king wins an epic victory against a giant African army and appears to completely lose the plot at the end of his life. Unlike in the Bible's previous account of his life, Asa doesn't just obliterate all Judah's pagan shrines, altars and poles, he also fortifies the nation's towns. Asa has a standing army of 580,000 men, which sees action when a gigantic invasion force from the African kingdom of Kush reaches within 30 miles of Jerusalem. That's 48 kilometres if you're outside the UK or America. Victory goes Judah's way, and the army of Kush disperses, chased as far as the Philistine region of Gerar, where villages are looted, livestock seized, and buildings destroyed. Asa of the second book of Chronicles is a religious reformer who not only purges pagan worship from his country, he organises a wholehearted revival in God worship. Emboldened by a prophet named Azariah who tells the king that God will have his back if he keeps loyal to him, Asa calls together all the leaders of Judah and Benjamin. He invites settlers from some of the other tribes and sacrifices a huge number of the animals captured from Gerar, threatening death to anyone who fails to follow God. Despite the fatal consequences of not publicly acknowledging God, the people of Judah seem genuinely converted and appear to be excited and energized by their newfound commitment. Asa is credited with removing his grandmother Maka from her role as Queen Mother, as she erected a pole to worship the pagan goddess Asherah, demonstrating that his faith is more important than family connections. Asa is unable to remove all of Israel's pagan shrines, as his remit is only the southern kingdom of Judah. In other news, he uses the loot stashed away in his temple treasuries to persuade Ben-Hadad of Aram to break his treaty with Israel and to stop fighting him. Once support from Aram has been cut off, Israel's king Baasha abandons his building projects at Ramah, just as he does in the first book of Kings. However, the chronicler adds in a ticking off given to Asa by a holy man called Hanani, who reports God's anger back to the king. Asa won a great victory against a much larger African force, so why did he doubt God's ability to protect him against Israel and Aram? In the Bible, treaty making is seen by God as a complete lack of faith, and Asa's punishment is that his country will now be permanently at war. To his shame, Asa locks Hanani up in prison and brutalizes some of Judah's people. When he succumbs to an ailment in his feet in his old age, the king asks help from his doctors, not God. Something else that is very much looked down on in the Bible. All in all, a disappointing fall from grace. Chronicler, the prophet Elijah might as well not have existed, and Israel's kings are simply mentioned in dispatches. The purpose of this book remains single-minded, to impress upon the newly released Israelites that their monarchy was ordained by God, who maintains a promise made to David that his line will last forever. Readers of the first book of Kings will remember Jehoshaphat as the godly son of Asa, who had the misfortune to rule Judah at the same time that the unhinged Ahab and his despotic wife Jezebel are on the throne of Israel. In the account in the first book of Kings, Jehoshaphat wants to seek God's opinion before joining a military coalition with four other kings. He also rids his country of male shrine prostitutes, and his mission to send off trading ships to bring back treasure from East Africa is scuppered when his fleet is wrecked before it can set sail. In the earlier book, Jehoshaphat is mentioned in the accounts of some of Israel's kings, but only warrants a 3-paragraph biography of his own. Here in the Chronicles, 4 whole chapters are given over to his reign, which clearly demonstrate his faith in God. 3 years after he descends to the throne, the king sends a party of officials and priests to take the Book of the Law on tour so that everyone in Judah has the chance to learn it. He builds forts and store cities to help him with military campaigns and amasses a standing army of over 1 million men. The account of the prophet Micaiah's promise to the 5 kings that the battle against Aram will not go their way is repeated almost verbatim from the first book of Kings. However, after narrowly escaping with his life, the Jehoshaphat of the second book of Chronicles is told by Jehu, son of the prophet Hanani, that God is furious with him for siding with someone as wicked as Ahab. Jehoshaphat still has some credit left in the bank, thanks to his purge of the nation's pagan shrines, and the chronicler paints a picture of a virtuous king who keeps his focus on God. Jehoshaphat launches into an administrative spring clean of his country, overhauling the judiciary by appointing unimpeachable judges in all Judah's fortified towns. In Jerusalem, he assigns priests and Levites to deal with disputes and orders all his officials to follow the laws of Moses and obey God. The chronicler reports how Jehoshaphat is brought gifts by Arabs, the first Bible mention of these nomadic tribespeople from the giant peninsula beyond Sinai. The second book of Chronicles also contains an account of an epic military victory that fails to make it into the first book of Kings. A vast army of Judah's neighbours, made up of Moabites and Ammonites, approaches from Edom, and Jehoshaphat immediately calls a fast. He stands in the courtyard of the temple and begs God to judge the invaders. The Israelites were forbidden from harming Moab or Ammon when they passed through their lands to settle in Canaan. And the king sees this as a hugely unjust repayment for honouring God's commands back in the days of Moses. A vast crowd of people has gathered to see how things pan out for the nation. And finally, a prophet called Jahaziel believes that he can hear God talking. He tells Jehoshaphat that God will do the fighting for Judah and describes exactly where the corpses of the enemy will be found. The king is overcome with either relief or joy and falls to the ground, worshipping God. The people follow suit and singers appointed by the king begin praising God at the tops of their voices. The next morning, the king reminds his soldiers to keep the faith, and they march out, accompanied by the singers, still praising the God whose love, they say, never ends. As Judah's army marches and sings, the chronicler describes how God sets ambushes for the enemy troops, who begin fighting one another. The ground zero, which Jahaziel described, is littered with the bodies of fallen soldiers, and it takes 3 days to gather the plunder. Readers are told that Jehoshaphat and his men return to Jerusalem with the same boisterous musical accompaniment which went with them into battle, completing the most tuneful military conquest in the Bible. All the nations surrounding Judah are cowed into submission after hearing about their neighbour's supernatural victory. And the account ends with a footnote to the failed trading voyage where Jehoshaphat's ships are wrecked. The reason given for this is that Jehoshaphat entered into a trading agreement with Israel's king Ahaziah. Alliances, it appears, are simply not in God's plan. The suggestion is that he will provide his people with all the victory and treasure they need, and so reliance on other nations shows a lack of faith in him. All in all, Jehoshaphat is certainly one of Judah's more high-achieving kings, but he fails to pass on any of his goodness or godliness to his feckless son and heir, Jehoram. While the second book of Kings spends its first 7 chapters marvelling at Elisha bringing dead children back to life and making iron axe heads float, the second book of Chronicles is only interested in Judah's succession and moves swiftly from Jehoshaphat to his son. Jehoram's first terrible act in his despotic reign is to put all his brothers to death so that there are no rivals to his throne, an act of genocide that escapes the writer of the books of Kings. His next black mark comes from marrying a daughter of Ahab, Israel's polytheistic king who seems eager to worship any deity as long as it is not God. The uprising by Edom, in which the king is surrounded yet manages to escape, is retold, and the chronicler adds that Jehoram builds pagan shelters and encourages the people of Jerusalem to prostitute themselves to foreign gods. Given that a king of Judah or Israel in Old Testament times is seen as a vice-regent of God and is expected to deport themselves accordingly, encouraging the worship of other deities is seen as a catastrophic breach of duty. The account of Jehoram's reign here includes a letter which he receives from the prophet Elijah, promising him a lingering death through bowel disease. It is cited as punishment for aligning himself to the pagan kings of Israel rather than following the example of his more virtuous father and grandfather, Jehoshaphat and Asa. This is Elijah's sole mention in the books of Chronicles, and, bizarrely, the episode doesn't appear in the second book of Kings. Bible fans struggle with Elijah's sudden appearance in Judah when his ministry in the books of Kings has been exclusively to Israel. If true, it suggests that the prophet must have survived at least 5 years into the reign of Joram of Israel, which is when Jehoram became king of Judah. Later, Jehoram suffers at the hands of the Philistines, the Arabs, and the Cushites, who raid his palace and take anything of value, including his wives and all but one of his sons. Jehoram becomes sick, and at the age of just 40, his bowels fall out, and he dies in agony. He is bundled into a grave in Jerusalem, but not the same one as David and the rest of his family, suggesting the disgrace into which he has brought his nation. next king is as much of a spiritual vandal as his father and leaves the monarchy in as perilous a place as it has ever been in. In the second book of Kings, Ahaziah simply assumes the throne on the death of his father Jehoram. The account here is much more dramatic. Raiders who are either from Arabia or who accompany a party of Arabs enter a compound where they slaughter all of Ahaziah's older brothers. Ahaziah is left as the only candidate to take over as Judah's king. For the chronicler, Ahaziah is not the king that Judah needs. His default religious standpoint is pagan, a life choice in which he is aided and abetted by his mother Athaliah, better known as Jezebel's daughter. The account of Ahaziah and Joram's coalition against Hazael, king of Aram, is retold. As in the second book of Kings, Joram is injured and recuperates in Jezreel, where he is visited by his friend Ahaziah. It is then that the accounts differ. In the earlier book, Ahaziah rides out of Jezreel with Joram to meet Jehu, Israel's military commander, who has arrived with an army at Joram's palace. When Joram is killed by an arrow, Ahaziah escapes in his chariot, but is hit too and reaches as far as Megiddo, where he also dies. In the second book of Chronicles, Jehu has already rounded up and killed relatives of Ahaziah who have been attending the king while he is visiting Joram. Ahaziah himself is in hiding in Samaria, and when he is eventually flushed out, he is brought to Jehu, who has him put to death, the only king of Judah or Israel to be killed by their opposite number. However, in the account of Ahaziah here, no mention is made that Jehu becomes Israel's king. Chronicles also ignores Jehu's efforts to bring the northern kingdom back under God's laws, and the only acknowledgement that he is king is where he is listed as the grandfather of Jehoash. The chronicler describes how Ahaziah dies, leaving no one powerful enough to keep the kingdom afloat, marking a new low point for Judah. The time has come for Jezebel's daughter to seize the throne for herself and to drag Judah even further away from the ideal rule set in place by David. Just as she does in the second book of Kings, Athaliah murders all Judah's baby princes, while her heroic stepdaughter Jehosheba rescues one of the tiny boys and hides him away in the temple for 6 years. What the earlier account doesn't tell readers is that Jehosheba is actually the wife of Judah's high priest, and the chronicler clearly wants everyone to know that her act of rescue is done because she follows God. This priest is Jehoiada, and the account of him calling the army to protect baby Joash and the subsequent coup against the evil queen mother is almost identical to that in the second book of Kings. The boy king is brought in triumph from the temple and placed on the royal throne, aged just 7 years old. The lengthy detail of his temple refurbishment is repeated, and it is then that the two accounts of Joash's reign differ. Joash in the book of Kings sees Jerusalem invaded by Hazael, king of Aram, and it takes all the treasure amassed by previous kings of Judah to persuade him to retreat. Joash is then murdered by his own officials. Chronicles goes into much greater detail about Joash's reign. The book reports the death of Jehoiada the priest at 130 years old after an esteemed life of spiritual and public service to Judah, marking a dramatic change in the nation's religious well-being. Chronicles Joash then bows to the opinion of his officials, who abandoned the formal worship of God and returned to the pagan spirituality of Jehoram and Ahaziah. The chronicler tells of prophets who are sent to try and get the nation back to a more God-centered spirituality, but who are roundly ignored by Judah's leadership. In one of the Bible's most shocking scenes, Jehoiada and Jehosheba's son Zechariah stands up in the temple and warns the people that no good will come of ignoring God. Zechariah is a priest like his father, and to his shame, Joash orders him to be killed. Zechariah is stoned to death, a high priest murdered in the courtyard of Solomon's temple by Judah's king. Worse still, Zechariah's parents were the ones who rescued Joash as a baby, and so the ingratitude is appalling. As he lies dying, Zechariah tells his king that he hopes God can see this and will punish Joash accordingly. Chronicles reports the invasion by Hazael, but in this account, the army plunders Judah rather than rides home with treasure given willingly by Joash. The Aramean force is described as being much smaller than Judah's, and the defeat is put down to God's anger at being abandoned by his people. According to the chronicler, Joash is badly wounded in the fighting, and his cartel of officials conspire to bump him off for killing Zechariah. They assassinate him in his bed, accomplishing the first coup in Judah's history. Rather than the conspirators choosing their ringleader to rule, as so often happens in the northern kingdom, Joash's 25-year-old son Amaziah is named king. Somehow, David's bloodline continues to cling to Judah's throne. Is written and produced by me, Chaz Bayfield, with music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. Please send any comments or feedback to contact@holybible.com, or you can find us on X, just search Holy Bible Podcast. Thank you all so much for listening, and see you next time.